thanks for coming to this session. I hope some of you have seen Ben's session. I will refer a little bit to what Ben Picard said before. I'm going to talk about business model, which is both a fairly simple and a fairly complex subject. I will try to keep it very simple because I'd rather have you leave this room with just a few ideas that are well understood than a bunch of ideas and a bunch of concepts that you will forget very quickly. So if at the end of this session you recall just three or four main ideas that are useful for your entrepreneurial view on things, I would be happy. Since we're in a movie theater, I thought it was appropriate to use a picture from Charlie Chaplin, you know, in one of these roles, a tramp, a poor guy with a violin and trying to survive like that. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs or would-be entrepreneurs or developers that are turning into entrepreneurs are a bit like that. They have talent, they have a good heart, but they lack, and they have hopes, they have big hopes of doing the next Facebook, but they lack some skills, some of which Ben has covered before, and one of which was business models, which means how can I make money in a way or another from my talent. So hope is not a business model. It's also a pun to a reference to a book, Hope is Not a Strategy, if some of you know. Okay, my name is Roald Sibrat. I have not put my Twitter account. I'm a big Twitter user. It's just my first name, Roald, R-O-I-L-D. So if you want to see my whereabouts. So again, we're in a movie theater, so I've tried to make this a little bit entertaining. Today I want to tell you about music. I'm going to tell you about business and Wall Street, and maybe not that type of business, but you know, a business logic and how business can be fascinating. The social network, the startup story of these past few years, and we're going to talk about cars as well. Maybe not this one, but anyway. Well, first of all, let me start by introducing myself. Who am I? In a few points, I used to do this kind of stuff. I'm trained as a computer science engineer. It was a while ago. I've forgotten most of it now. I don't know whether I have to apologize, but it was a while ago. I used to work with the first HTTPD servers when it was still a university protocol, not yet a commercial venture. So I've pretty much seen the whole of the internet growth. I moved quickly towards business and marketing, especially startups. I've studied business in Solvay, in Brussels, and in Louvain, but I thought it was more exotic to put a picture of Stanford Business School, where I did study as well in back in 99, 2000. It was a great time to be there with the height of the internet bubble. Really fascinating to feel the vibe that you see in San Francisco and the Silicon Valley in general. That changes, even if you spend just a few weeks there. It can change the way that you look at opportunity and ventures. I've been involved in a number of startups as a founder or co-founder. Winbox was maybe the biggest one, or it was not a success. It was back in 99, 2000. We developed a system that basically gave an email address to every mobile phone. So it was a huge market that would turn every mobile phone into an email box by using your number, 3247 blah blah, at winbox.com. It would create a mailbox, even if you didn't know about it. We raised $5 million. It was the craziness of the time. And my investors, US-based business angels, big business angels with deep pockets, they said, oh, this is going to be like Hotmail, except bigger. So they were so convinced that we were going to be bigger than Hotmail, because three times more people have a mobile phone than they have a PC. The thing, and so we grew. We went from three people to 30 people, opened a few countries, opened in Germany, opened in the UK, had 200,000 customers, started to get traction, but we lacked a business model. So you can see that I... I'm going to tell you about a subject that has burned me deeply, because when the market bubble exploded in 2000, we were not able to raise our next round of $5 or $10 million, because it was a money losing business. Basically, every new user would cost us $3 and earn us $1. Therefore, we were losing money for every new customer, and we had no business, no real business model like other companies at the time. But anyway, so lots of lessons learned in there. And now I'm also involved in a number of other startups, and I love startups. If you couldn't tell, I work with Ben Picard for the Boost Camp in Wallonia. And I've also been involved with the Founder Institute, with the WSL, which is an incubator for engineering students in Wallonia. And just this week, I started doing a program for engineering students at the Polytech de Mons to raise their awareness of business entrepreneurship and so on. So enough about me. That was already too much. The main ideas that I want to impart on you is, first of all, what is a business model? How can we define it? How can we understand what it means? Why is it important? Why should you care? And why should just about anyone in a company, if you ask me, should care? The main building blocks, you know, it's a modular thing, so you understand it through building blocks. All of that can apply both to a startup or a large company. The majority of the business model thinking can apply to a large company, obviously, also to startups. But a startup is a different animal. So in a second part, I will talk about how does this impact startups differently than large companies. And a few examples and an invitation to test this by yourself. Okay, I'll start with a violinist story. You know, I have a big screen, I have a sound, so I wanted to try something. So this I don't know if some of you know this story. This has been an experiment in the subway of Washington, D.C. It has been filmed, and, you know, they were watching with a violinist in the station how many people would stop, how many people would listen to him, you know, how much people would give. And so it was basically an experiment in... rush hour. And basically very few people stopped. Just a few people, 5 or 6 people stopped, and children did stop. A few people gave through money without even stopping. And all in all, but it's been accelerated. You see that very few people stop. Some people give a little bit of money. Okay, this lasted about 45 minutes, and the guy made $32. And now, violin story, part two. Actually, the violinist was Joshua Bell. He's one of the most talented violinists in the world. And he was playing in the metro with his 3 million Stradivarius. So it was about the best musical experience that you could experience. He was playing some very fine pieces by Bach, some of the most delicate music that has been composed. So you had the chance, if you were in the subway, to experience one of the best musical experience. And nobody stopped, and he got $32. Of course, there are many lessons that can be taken out of that. There are some philosophical lessons, of course. There are, you know, how busy are we not even to notice that? And, you know, can we spot beauty when we're in front of it? Are people in such a rush? And so on. And, you know, this has been commented as a... It's kind of a philosophical point of view. I thought it was interesting to look at it from a business model point of view as well, because the lesson that I take is, you know, however gifted people are, talent is not enough. His talent as a violinist is not enough. And here I put someone who was probably a talented programmer at some point. You recognize very tired Bill Gates about more than 30 years ago. To make it into a business, you have to have a business model. Some building blocks were missing in the metro that can be found in the usual setting of this guy. You know, he plays with the best orchestra, and seats go for about $100 per seat when he plays. So what a contrast, right? And now I'm going to tell you about what building blocks. How can we see? How can we compare the guy in the same talent in the metro without a real business model and in a concert hall? You know, and why does it matter? It's very simple. It's because it can kill your business. It can kill or make your business. And this is something that I'm really keen on. Is I've seen, you know, many people, many entrepreneurs with good ideas, and some spend months of their lives developing program and developing code and building things, and because they don't have the right business model, they tend to fail in the long run. They tend to exhaust themselves after, you know, months and even years of developing their thing and believing in it and sticking to their plan and getting exhausted. So I think that's one of the reasons why I'm so keen about talking about business model. It's because it can make or break your business, basically. Because in the long run, the winner is not the one that has the best technology. You know, and as developer, IT people, engineers, programmers, we tend to be attuned to the best technology, and we want our stuff to be perfect, and we tend to think that the winner will be the one with the best technology. And in reality, sometimes it is the case, but more and more so, the winner is the one with the best business model. And it's a very hard thing to get out of our brains, because the 20th century, basically, if you look at it, has been marked by technological progress, from the first airplanes in 1900s to the smartphones of today. Most of the economic growth of the 20th century was based on technological advances. So we tend to think, if we will win through great technology. It's still true in some aspect, but if you don't have the right business model, it won't fly. So what I'm going to tell you about today is basically based about two books. One is Business Model Generation, which is becoming fairly well known, a very beautiful book, by the way. And I'm sure some of you have heard about it, so this is going to be a repeat session for some of you. Maybe you'll get some insights. But very often when it's presented, it's just presented by itself, and I think it's extremely it's necessary for an entrepreneurial perspective to pair it with the customer development approach championed by Stephen Blank with this book, The Four Steps to the Epiphany. It's an ugly book, but it's very smart. It's not a nice layout, but it's a very smart book about how as a startup you have to not work just on your product development, which is the natural trend of the engineer or the developer, but you have to work on the customer development as well. You have to make sure that both development converge, the way you develop your product and the way you develop your customer understanding. So let's dive into the business model. Okay, the title of the book is Business Model Generation. The tool that is used in it is Business Model Canvas. It uses sort of the canvas like a painting that uses 9 building blocks that I'm going to go through. And I will refer to the example of the violinist to, you know, to make sure that you get the concept. And that's the beauty of it. It can work with any project that is supposed to bring in money at some point. So it can apply to a large corporation. It can apply to a startup. It can apply to a violinist on the corner of the street that wants to earn a living. The first one is customer. Well, it depends on the way you look at things. You could argue that the first one is the one in the middle, the value proposition, but it's always good to start with the customer. Which customer and users are you serving? And you see that in the metro, it's people passing by. You don't know them. There is no segmentation, actually. Whereas in a concert hall, you have people that come because they are a music lover. You have people that come because they have learned the violin. You have people that come because they have high, they are high class, and they think it's so smart to go to a concert hall. So you have all sorts of customers that are interested in what the violinist is proposing. Value proposition, it could look the same. In both cases, it's an excellently played violin piece, but you can see that in a concert hall, then you have a whole experience. It's you're well seated. You have a bar. You're not in a rush. You're not in a cold of the metro. So already there, it's different, and you start to understand why it's so different to have the same talent in a metro or in a concert hall. The channels, of course, in any business, you know, how do you bring what you're offering to your customers? Is it direct? You know, in the subway, it was direct contact. That's great, but it's probably better to have partners, to have channels. Ben has talked about how Microsoft has a partner model. You don't go to Microsoft directly. You go most of the time through partners, and those partners are the way that you can have a spread. Joshua Bell has a ticket office, you know, people working to bring his ticket and the awareness of his concert to his public. The relationship, what type of relationship do you entertain with your customers? You know, in the case of the violin player, it's people who have already a CD, people who are subscribed to the newsletter of the concert hall. A different kind of intimacy or knowledge between the product or what is proposed and the customer. Of course, how do you get money? You know, in one case you get money thrown in your trunk. In the other case, there's a ticket office, there's a CD office, and so on. The key resources, you know, and I'm sure you can apply this to your venture, to your startup, or to your product. What do you need to build or to provide your services? This is the left part of the graph. The right part is, you know, the customer and how you get to there and what revenues you get out of it. The left part is you know, what does it take to bring this value proposition to the customer? The key resources, in one case it's a concert hall and so on, so it's not small feat. Key activities, there. In both cases, you could argue it's just hours of practicing playing, but you can also say that in a professional player would have to go through promotional activities, go to talk to the press, go on TV, and so on. Key partners, of course, in any business, you're never alone. You're very rarely alone in your business, so this is a key component. Who benefits from your business actually is a good question to ask yourself. Not just who am I selling to, is who else can benefit from my business and therefore become a partner, and what is the cost structure. And here you can see that you have pretty much a very complete way, with those 9 building blocks, a very complete way to describe almost any type of business. See, those are the 9 components. You can start most of the time with the value proposition, what I'm doing. And we see a lot of entrepreneurs coming to us and saying, oh, this is what I'm building. And that's all they can say. They can just talk about the central part. Oh, that's what I'm building. And most of the time they talk about it in terms of a thing. This is something I've built. They don't talk about it in terms of a value proposition to a customer. That is reach through some channels, that implies a certain type of relationship, that brings such and such revenues, that has such cost structure because of activities and resources and partners. So this is something that can be put into a graph, it can fit on one piece of paper, and you can explain all the components of your business model. Maybe I have this video that just summarizes this all. I apologize for those who already know the tool, but for those who don't know, I think it takes a little bit of repetition to soak in.
A An organization's business model can be described with 9 basic building blocks: your customer segments, your value proposition for each segment, the channels to reach customers, customer relationships you establish, the revenue streams you generate, the key resources and key activities you require to create value, the key partners, and the cost structure of the business model. But it's not sufficient to just enumerate the 9 building blocks. What you really want to do is to map them out on a pre-structured canvas. This is what we call the business model canvas, a tool that helps you map, discuss, design, and invent new business models. Let's briefly go through the 9 building blocks, starting with the customer segments. These are all the people or organizations for which you're creating value. This includes simple users and paying customers. For each segment, you have a specific value proposition. These are the bundles of products and services that create value for your customers. The channels describe through which touch points you're interacting with customers and delivering value. The customer relationships outline the type of relationship you're establishing with your customers. Revenue streams make clear how and through which pricing mechanisms your business model is capturing value. Then you need to describe the infrastructure to create, deliver, and capture value. The key resources show which assets are indispensable in your business model. The key activities show which things you really need to be able to perform well. The key partners show who can help you leverage your business model, since you won't own all key resources yourself, nor will you perform all key activities. Then once you understand your business model's infrastructure, you'll also have an idea of its cost structure. So with the business model canvas, you can map out your entire business model in one image. This works for startup entrepreneurs just as well as for the most senior executives.
Okay, so this summarizes pretty well the different components, and you can go to the website where you have a copy of the 71st pages of the book for free, and everything, and of course a link to Amazon and to other services to buy the book, because obviously the book, a book on innovative business model, was also built in a innovative way, and it was a huge success, you know, in a market where there are 10,000 different business books published every year, and most of them don't publish more than 1,000 copies. They managed to do 100,000 copies in the past year. They're now translated in about 20 languages, and they build it. They managed to do it in a way that was financed by the first readers, the first people taking part into the workshops. So people would pay to go to a workshop to practice those elements with I didn't mention him already, Axel Osterwalder, the a Swedish PhD who designed this concept and this book. And so basically the book was paid for, and the production of it was paid for by the first reader and the first workshop participants. So again, that was innovative for the book industry. Okay, now you may ask, all right, what do I do of this? You know, okay, that's a model. We were used to be working with model. What do I do with this model? You know, what do I make of it? How can it be? How can it serve my project, my business? Well, use it as a toolbox. You know, it's something that you have to get used to, by the way. So even for the people who already have heard of this, it's something that you can never practice enough. We notice this when we work on business models with Ben at the Microsoft Innovation Center. Every new interaction, we learn new slants on things, and we find new ways of using the tool. Obviously, well, it's not that obvious, so that's why I'm turning into a slide. Business model needs to be designed. You have to think and design your business as a plan. Like, you don't start a house without having a plan. You don't start coding without having a plan, normally, right? You're supposed to planify a little bit things. You can adjust later, but you need to have an initial plan. And so that's why. So this is the the one-page view. It can be put into posters at the Mickey Mouse. We have a big wall posters, 3 meters by 2, with this, and we work on it with Post-it. That's, by the way, one of the main reasons why it's useful. It's because it's visual, and we are visual beings. We remember things much better visually than by just information, just reading books. You know, when it's visual, then at least you can understand. You can understand the relationships. You can move things around. You work on this with post-it notes. You can use different colors. You can say, all right, I'm going to put the business model for my B2C, my consumer activities, in yellow. And then I'm going to think about a B2B, a business-to-business model, in green, and compare the two and see what the relationships are. So this is really something you have to try to realize it and to understand. And by the way, it's fun. You know, you can argue, you can say, no, hey, why don't we do like this and like that? And it's often one of the ways that when we have a new product coming at MIC, we ask people, hey, can you explain? Okay, you can pitch your story, but now let's work it on the board. Let's move things around. Let's check this. Let's cross this out. And once we agree, we get to an agreement on what the main building, the 9 building blocks are. It can take an hour, easily. Then we have quite an understanding of the person's business. Also, and obviously, but it bears saying, it's a communication tool. You know, I used to have another presentation saying that developers are from Mars and marketers or people are from Venus. You know, sometimes you feel they're on two completely different planets. The developers are happy. For them, their unit of progress is when they crunch code. Every new line of code is a progress. For marketers, it's every new unit sold. So people are not on the same planet. The good thing about the business model canvas is that it's pretty much neutral. It's not really taught yet in business school, so the business people are not especially aware of that most of the time. So now it's a common ground that even developers can understand. Oh, I can understand that if I bring this feature, it will change the value proposition. It will enhance the relationship with this group of customers. Therefore, it will bring more business. That's something that pretty much anyone in a company can understand. And I think from that point of view alone, it's a very precious tool. And finally, you know, you get to work with Post-it, and it's always fun. And I've taken this from an actual Post-it advertisement. I don't know what they did. I think it's very appropriate. We're the day after Valentine's Day, so this is always nice. Maybe some of you woke up this morning like this. Anyway, so it's becoming a lingua franca between people to discuss and understand businesses. This is a business model, and you can apply to pretty much any type of business, small, large, startup, established. This is the business model canvas for the Financial Times, and we can go through it together. I don't know how am I timing wise. Yes, should be okay. So you can see that who are the customer segments from Financial Times? Well, a global business community, but also advertisers. You know, and you already noticed that a lot of businesses don't have just one customer or one customer segment. They have two customer segments easily. And you know, very well-known examples are all the web services that give something for free to the users, like Google search, right? But their customers are the advertisers. And so a lot of new business models now are based on that segmentation of customers. You know, we won't go through all of it, but let me point out the customer relationship, because that's where some interesting things can happen. Ben mentioned what could happen with the dentist accounting software. You know, because of the relationship that you have with your customers, all sorts of ancillary business can happen, and you can already see this here. When you have, as a publisher, A few years ago, it was a website of a publisher. You go to Le Soir or The Standard, and you read the page, and that's about it. More and more, they have inserted profiling things. They ask you to register. Why do they do that? Because it increases their relationship with you as a reader. Therefore, they can bring more value. They can bring targeted advertising. They can tell their advertisers, don't just put the same advertising for everyone. If you can put cooking advertising for only for a woman, and sorry for the stereotype, or if you can put big cars for a man or for depending on the age and so on, then you can extract more value from the relationship that you have with your customer. So when you are a business, let's imagine you are responsible for a project at a publisher, zooming in on the customer relationship aspect, how intimate are we with our readers? This can bring a lot of value. How are we distributed? Are we just on our side and hoping that people type our address or search in a search engine and get to us? Or do we have distribution deals where we have a widget that is on another website? Those things are little strategic elements that can be mapped onto this, that can be conveyed to the rest of your team. If you are in marketing, in business, in technology, that you can use this as a way to convince people, hey, we should do this widget because it will change our distribution. And if someone comes up with an idea that doesn't fit anywhere in here, it's probably not a very good idea. Also, I think it's quite complete. That means if you cover all the 9 blocks, you've pretty much covered all the bases. So it happens too often that we have first-time entrepreneurs coming to us and saying, oh, my idea is to do this, and sometimes they talk about the customer segments. Very often they don't have an idea of their cost structure. Very often they don't have an idea of what partner network they would need, who would be their early partners. And so there are completely blind spots in the way that they see their business. And just by using this and promoting this, we believe that it's a way to go faster and to make sure everyone understands things pretty much in the same way. As I said, it's an easy way to share, to adjust, to discuss, to move things around. It's especially telling if you have a live board with live post-it on it. This is an example from Facebook. I'm sure pretty much everyone can understand what's in there, right? You have in yellow a social network platform that addresses users globally, 500 million users at the time. Then you have in orange, the value proposition is ads. Is you're serving an audience for ads. So you're taking your users and you're serving them with the right demographics to advertisers. There, your customer segment is advertisers, those type of advertisers. And then you have another line of business for games and apps and developers that use the API, the application interface to develop things. This is one thing that is possible with this model is you can unbundle things. Oftentimes in a business, things are bundled together and hard to take apart. Telcos are a good example. In a telecom operator, oftentimes they have a technology infrastructure, they have a customer relationship, they have a service and application, and it's intermingled and makes it very hard to know what you can change. If you unbundle, this goes especially for large businesses, if you unbundle the layers, how do we work as a pure technology provider? How do we work as a service provider and so on? Then you can isolate where new value can be created in a business model. Now, that's helpful for a telco, for a Proximus or a Mobistar, let's say, or a base that would want to think, hey, how can we play as a bank? Because we have a relationship with people, we send them bills or they're prepaid. They are mobile. The mobile payments are coming. How can we think about the mobile payment opportunity for a telco? And then you can start you can start mapping your value proposition, the relationship that you have with your existing customer segments. You probably need new partners. You need to build new partnerships with banks. You have to develop new activities and figure out a revenue model. That means how do we get paid by transactions and things like that. So it really is a tool that that can facilitate discussion and understanding between partners, between founders, if it's a startup venture. And you'd better, for those who didn't know it already, you'd better go and buy the book. Well, I wish I had a dollar for or a euro for every book bought, because I'm sounding like I'm very much promoting it, but it's getting really everywhere. So and now it's in French. I think it's in Dutch as well. So you have no excuse anymore. All right. Now, second part, and after these two parts, I will get into an example with a startup that I know quite well that is based here in Brussels. So I hope the example will be telling for you. Second part is the other part of the book. What I've said so far applies equally to startup companies or to large businesses. It's just a frame of mind to think about how can my business bring revenue. This one is more for startups, or at least for entrepreneurial ventures. In a large company, launching a new division can be an entrepreneurial venture. And here, this book by Steve Blank, he's a teacher from Berkeley University, now at Stanford. One way that I like to think of it is, you know, we used to think a startup is like a company, just smaller. It's the same animal, but it's just smaller. And therefore, all the same logic from business school applies the same, which is true to some point, but which is false to some other point. And it's important to make the difference between the two, because in my opinion, the reality is that the startup is a different animal. You know, it's like a cat and a dog. It's the same vet can cure both, but it's still a different animal. And you have to pay attention to the differences. And management science shouldn't be completely the same. And why is that so? It's because, and Steve Blank pretty much is the guy who came up with this, the way to frame it, this insight like this, is a company solves a problem that is known. We already know most of the parameters, and we can just adjust, we are going to target this market, or we are going to open this market, and there are two or three parameters that can change. Whereas a startup, maybe they don't know it at first, but they solve an unknown problem. The problem has like 45 unknown parameters that you have to nail down one after the other. And that makes a big difference. And only then, and a way to see it is, a startup is something that is learning to become a company. After some point, after some zigzags, then you've nailed enough parameters, and you can start as a real company and hire the people with suits and ties and run it like any other business almost. One way to see this for people that have an IT background, it's a summary, right? What I'm going to say is very simplified, but there's some truth in it, and it will make you understand why this is true and why we have to do something about it. You know, things used to be developed like a long time ago, like 30 years ago or 40 years ago, which is very long in IT, along the waterfall model, right? We do the requirements, the design, the specs, and so on, the implementation, testing, and so on. This works, right? This is what has put man on the moon. This is what runs your bank software most of the time. The problem is known, and once you can specify it precisely enough, the solution is known as well. It's just a matter of time, of project management, of controlling costs, and so on. And that, by the way, for those type of problems, the development tends to go to India, because if things can be specified in the very least detail and there is no adjustment needed, then it can be... development can become somewhat of a commodity and be shipped overseas. Fortunately for development here, things tend to change. The problem is known, but the way to answer it is not known, and that has been the rise of agile methodologies Here I've taken the illustration from XP. Think Agile, and I'm sure in the room there are people that know Agile much better than I do, but from what I know, it has less than 10 years in its mainstream mainstream acceptance. I recall people at Nokia, like in 7 or 8 years ago when they were still great, having to come up with a new product, with a new phone and a little software on it every 8 weeks, because that was their production cycle. Then you have to be able to adjust and to take, you cannot specify everything. You know, if Motorola comes out with something else, you have to adjust, be able to adjust really quickly. So the problem is known, what you have to deliver is known, but the way to do it, the path to do it isn't known. And customer development and what a startup does or should do has the solution is unknown, but the problem is unknown as well. You tend to think that you can express the problem that your startup is solving first, but most of the time it's off the bat. So you have to use hypotheses, experiment inside, and feed that into a development which better be agile, because you cannot define it very precisely, and take from that the learnings and what the market has said and what the first customer have said, and feed it back into how you define and how you understand your problem. And this has to run as a circle, but not just as a technical point, but feedback into the way that you define the problem that you're trying to solve. And that, I think, is very important. Maybe if there's two or three things that you should get from this session is really understanding how the first elements of solution can be feedback into the way you define the problem with a real customer, not just ideas, oh, we're going to do this and that, to change the way to interact and to change the way that the solution is designed. I'll give you an example later, otherwise this is a bit of abstract. So what should you do with all this? There's not one business model that will solve everything. So the idea is to generate multiple business models. Oh, we have this idea. How could we do it? We could address high-end paying customers with this type of relationship and that. You know, and you generate one canvas like that. And then we could do a freemium model where we offer something for free, but then we entice people to upgrade and to buy into more services. That would be another. And then you end up with 5 or 10 or more potential business models with variants. You know, so it's quite a bit of work, but it's better to do it before than to just pick one and run with one and say, oh, we'll try selling to high-end customers first. And again, you'll see this in action in the example. The thing is, we should be honest and understand that everything that we put in a business model canvas at first are just hypotheses. It's my best guess as, all right, I think that is my customer segment. I think that is something I could build as a value proposition. You can know what you can build, but you don't know how it will be perceived as value proposition. So it is still a guess as well. And the revenue model, you can say, all right, I'll sell this at 10 euros a month, a web service, but you don't know whether it will fly or not. Therefore, all this is our guesses. And it's very important to realize that and to be... and not to execute before you've understood what is behind those guesses. There used to be a fight of ideas between people saying, oh, in startups, the idea is everything that counts. I used to be someone very keen on ideas, having a great idea. And there would be other people, more like Ben maybe, saying, oh, execution is the only thing that counts. You know, it's how you execute on your idea. And the truth is a bit of both. Execution is very important, but executing on the bad business model is won't help you. So having a good idea and a good execution, but not having solved the business model equation, won't lead you to success either. So that's what Steve Blank has captured into this customer development cycle. That means once you have your first value proposition, you go into customer discovery mode. Who will need this? Can I have an appointment with those people? And you validate step by step. And there's a very precise way to do this in three sub-steps and at every step and so on. You have to look at this book. And until you have, until the customer has validated this with you, something is still not right, and you have to change, and you have, that's the term he coined, I think, is pivot. You know, you have to pivot into something else, you have to change something, and come back and restart, and come with a value proposition or a business model that is slightly changed or radically changed, and come back to the customer until you have validated. And only then you can say, all right, now I nail my customer, I know where he is, and go on. This is more typical. I want to emphasize again that this is more typical for startup companies than for large companies. If you are a mobile operator, you launch a product. You know that you know, when it came to prepaid, you knew that prepaid would work because it worked already in the UK and so on. So you had other elements that you didn't really have to validate that will prepay work. Yes, it will work. Yeah. And the parameters were more what budget should I allow to this or that. But the question whether it would work or not was not the point. Whereas in a startup, you don't know at all. You start from a blank sheet, and that's a big difference. This has been put together by what is called the Lean Startup. I'm sure some of you must have learned of Lean Startup. It's by Eric Ries, who used to be a CTO of IMView, a 3D avatar chatting environment. And he took the courses of Steve Blank and put the pieces together in what he called the Lean Startup. The main goal of this would be, how can we go as fast as we can in a learning cycle? How can we have ideas, build something with it, turn it into a product, see what it works, you know, measure how it works, does it work or not, are users ramping up or not, get the data, learn, and iterate. When they had built their, so they had spent months of development time doing a 3D avatar chat that was interoperable with the MSN Messenger, JTalk, 13 different instant messaging clients, and when they launched, nobody would download the software, pretty much. So they said, oh, what happens? And they tried to understand. Then they realized they could have just put a, and for some reasons, people would not download that type of software that they had built. And actually, they could have known much more easily by just putting one web page saying, hey, if you are interested in a 3D client, subscribe here. Or click download here and put a page behind saying, oh, sorry, it's not available right now. You understand what I'm saying? Is they would have saved themselves months of development if they had just put one page saying, this is what we're offering or soon, and tell us whether you're interested. Because they would have noticed that the people were not interested by what they were proposing. So they had to change, and they would have gained 6 months in doing so. So I think that is really one of the key lessons. This is very American, by the way. Is they have this saying: learn to fail fast. You know, if you're going to fail, don't drag it for 2 or 3 years. Just fail fast, fail in a few months, and then pivot or restart something else. And here in Belgium, in Europe, in general, we tend to have a culture of it's good. It's already a startup with 2 or 3 people, and let's try and keep it alive. And I tend to agree with the American style there. It would be better to shut it down and to start something new. I've already seen a fund manager in Belgium pitching, we have 17 startups in our portfolio and started like 10 years ago, and 16 are still alive. So he was proud of the fact that many of the startups were alive. But how many became something great? Maybe one. I think one was really thriving. And the rest were what a US VC would call the living dead. You know, companies doing, you know, staying in 2 or 3 people, needing to be recapitalized every once in a while. And it was clear that they would never grow and explode, and it's the worst for a US VC because you have to still put money and you have to go to board meeting and you have to review the accounting and so on, and it won't lead nowhere. So learn to fail fast or learn to adjust. Of course, you don't have to fail. If you can take enough lessons to adjust and make it into a success, then that's good. So that's pretty much what I said. Adjust your business model until you can prove it works. So don't build a big, don't spend months and months of software development into something until you can prove that it works, because you can show that you have a customer. You know, what's the proof? That's a big question. You know, what's the proof that it works? I've seen a company that they're very much interested. You know, I've heard that many times, but that doesn't count. And especially since it's biased, because a startup entrepreneur is like a teenager. He or she is very sensitive to how people look at him or her, and every compliment is amplified 100 times. Oh, he said that my project is interesting, you know, and sometimes it's a guy just, instead of saying, oh, just leave me alone, has said, oh yeah, it's interesting, right? And the guy thinks that he has really the greatest project. What is the proof? A trial. That's already better. You know, if the company has agreed to, all right, we'll try this and that. But if they don't pay, it doesn't prove you have a business. It proves you have working software. But some companies agree to try something just to please you, and more especially because it doesn't cost them anything. What is approved? A proof is a signed deal. It's something that a customer is willing to pay money for. And so how do you get to a signed deal? Well, you stop playing with your whiteboards and your post-it and your business model, and you get out of the building. That's one of the rally cries of Steve Blank, is get out of the building. A lot of startups, especially from technical people, tend to be on the quest for the ever perfect software or the greatest feature set. And people add features, and oh, this is going to be the feature. Think that they're going to win the war because of feature, and nothing can be further from the truth. You have to get out of the building and see whether it shops. That's why I put a building as a shopping basket. If it doesn't work, pivot or change something. And then I would like to emphasize pivot. Doesn't mean, in dancing or in anything, it means you keep one foot on the ground, right? You don't completely jump elsewhere. You pivot by changing one thing and staying one and keeping one foot of what you've done previously pretty much the same. Now let's jump into an example, right? Because it's getting too abstract. Django. Django is a cool startup, young founders, they're just out of college. I know 3 out of 4 of them. Maybe some of you know them. They've worked with Solvay Entrepreneurs, the MIC Founder Institute, so they're well-bred. They have a cool concept of which is in the right spirit of the time, of how can we reduce pollution, car traffic, and so on, and CO2, and all the durable concerns. And so they came up with their first idea of Django. So I've discussed with them, and I'm showing this with their approval and everything. And they've digged in their early slides for me to be able to bring this. Their original concept was, oh, let's imagine I want to go from Braine-l'Alleud to Ghent, and let's imagine someone else has the same application as I do, and they're just going to the same route at the same time. We could meet through this Django mobile application and meet each other and give points and badges and everything. And they had a whole social and gamification. You could give points and you could split revenues. And so it was very elaborate. So they had already spent weeks, if not months, of devising this. They had done a business model. So that's another big lesson, is that it's not a panacea. It's not because you're using this business model canvas that you're going to do something smart. That's why I insisted on the second part. That means testing your business model. So they had the business model, drivers, passengers, value proposition was to allow matching. Some it was free, some for it was for a commission, CO2 credits, and everything. So they had thought of a business model, but it was missing, you know, other elements, right? Obviously, this will not fly until you have critical mass, until you have hundreds, 100,000 people with the application. Otherwise, the chance that people would have the application running and be ready to do that was just too random, and would. So, in my opinion, in others, this was going to be a crash, right? But it's no big deal, right? Nobody was killed, and it will allow that since they recognized that early enough in just a few months. All right, this we are getting for the fifth time. We're getting the feedback that this will not work in C2C, in people to people, driving from one place to another. They were able to pivot, and you can see that they kept one foot on the ground. Right, they didn't completely take off, and they came up with a new version, a revised version, an event car sharing. That means instead of doing from anywhere to anywhere, let's have a fixed destination. Like it could have been for this event, right? There were hundreds of people converging to Braine-l'Alleud, so their service could have been used for to facilitate carpooling, car sharing. There is a model. So this is something that they had built, right? They have built all the software, the website, everything, the Facebook plugins and everything to make that work. And they tried it, so it's good, you know, to test it. They had an agreement with the RTBF DG Experience. They had started an agreement with the Forêt Nationale for the concerts, you know, to bring people together by car sharing. So you can see that this is already much better in terms of business model, because it changes several elements of the nine blocks of our business model canvas, right? The value proposition has changed. It's to a fixed destination. The type of relationship that we have is different, because we know that people are going to a concert or something. It's not just random thing. Event organizers are becoming partners. They can promote it. You know, this was promoted on the website of RTBF for their DJ Experience event. So this is already much better, right? So my hope in showing you this is, you know, how can you use the elements, the understanding that you have of the nine elements of a business model, to improve from a version 0.5, which is kind of a cool idea and nice for the planet, and Nicolas Hulot would be proud of you and everything, but it wouldn't fly, into something that starts to look like a business. Then they improved it again, saying, hey, this is going to be slow growth because there aren't that many events. You know, there's only Wechter is only, you know, once or twice a year. Tech Days is only once a year. And so, and they change again to make it into a B2B car sharing. So then they say, all right, there are people that go once a year to some event, but there are people that go every day to their job. And they articulated a value proposition for companies, saying to large companies, hey, GSK in Wavre and Rixensalle, there are, I don't know, 3,000 people driving to your offices every morning. Can we try and help you fix that? Oh yes, why not? Come and talk to us. So again, testing on the ground, getting out of the building was key into their ability to come up with a different solution, different type. Again, it changes the elements in a business model, different partners, different relationships. You can see that the value, instead of having, in their first model, they had to split cents between, you know, 7 cents per kilometer that had to be split between the driver and with an approval system and so on. Here you can start to go in 500 euros, 1,000 euros and so on, depending on the number of users and depending on the having a per user or per kilometer. And it works. Now we
Hello? Hello? Yeah. All right.
Okay, now they have a business. And I think underlying this, there's a deep deep lesson for anyone in technology wanting to develop a business is the success does not depend on the technology that you've developed. Here, they had the same programmers all along that they had done a pretty good job in developing the website. The first website or mobile application was going to be useless for lack of a critical size, critical mass, and so on. With the application they had between this one, the event car sharing, and the B2B car sharing is pretty much the same. You know, they have changed, I think they have changed less than 10% of their application. But the business model has changed radically. They have built their value proposition for businesses, and they solve lots of sub-points for the business. They take care of the fiscal aspect because it's complicated depending on whether it's a company car or a personal car. It's a nightmare to understand, you know, what are the fiscal implications that for the company, especially if you want to compensate your employees, if you want to give incentives and so on. So it could become a headache. They're solving this headache. You know, again, a big lesson of trying to solve a pain. You know, one good question to ask entrepreneurs is, are you provider of aspirin or of vitamins? Because if it's vitamin, it's long-term benefit, and people don't see too much the need. If it's aspirin, that means people have a headache that they need your product to solve. And here, once the companies are open to the idea of fostering carpooling, then they say, oh, we'd rather have you do that than do it ourselves. So now they have a business thanks to this shift in business model. And I think I'm getting closer to my conclusion now. I hope that the ideas that I've shared allow you to see that there is a huge avenue open for innovation that is not so much technological, but that is based on business model innovation. And I think, you know, in our country we have research centers for all sorts of things. I think we should have a research center on business model innovation. Maybe that's what we already do at the MIC. That means the technological part is just one part. There remain many things to be done and seen on the business model side. I have given one example. I'm sure all of you have in the back of your head some other examples. If you know Sendawi, it's a crowd-funded comic strip BD editor, and they had a slow start. You know, they started like 2 years ago, I think. The first albums were hard to raise, so basically you could buy the album in advance. You know, there was the guy would do the one or two planches, huh? And he would say, hey, this is one I'm going to do 45 of these, and this is going to be a great story about this and that, and here are the first two. Who wants to invest in my comic strip? And people would say, all right, I'll put 10 euros and I'll get a free copy, or I put 20 and I'll have a free copy or two copies, and so on. And now regularly they raised, like you can see here, 40,000 invested. It's fully invested, so the cartoonist only starts when his product is fully funded. And you can see here, it's not so much a technological feat. It doesn't require a technological prodigy to run that. But it takes a deep rethinking of the business model of printing, of book distribution, and also I believe an entrepreneurial spirit in adjusting, because their first model they had to adjust, and you know, between the first idea and the idea that they have now, there has been quite a long road. Another thought, today, 15 February, is the anniversary of the start of the first commercial computer. Back in 1946, ENIAC was the first computer, and it made me thought on the evolution of computing. There used to be like 5 computers in the world. Then there was the vision of mostly Bill Gates, a PC on every desktop. And it has, you know, that in itself is a revolution in business model thinking. Right? It's my customer will be anyone, any professional person, and any person at home with a computer.
That was a great vision, and everything else and the partners needed for that and so on. And now we're kind of converging back to having five computers in the world, or five cloud clusters, let's say, you know, the Amazon, the Microsoft, Google, and a few others. And this enables lots of new models based on the cloud computing, like Ben discussed with his famous accounting for dentist pet example. And the change in business model is not just having a monthly fee instead of an upfront fee. The part of the business model canvas that captures where it changes most, I believe, is the customer relationship. You know, the one in the upper right corner. Once people are using an application in the cloud, you have a closer and a return relationship, and you gain more and more and more information about the customer, and you are able to bring other partners on board and deliver new value and create new revenue stream. So I think we're living now in a very exciting period to innovate on business model. All right, so now let me recap. That's the end of it, right? I think I'm pretty much on time, or maybe a little bit earlier. The basic ideas that I wanted to leave you with was, it's important to think of business model because it can win or kill your business. We've seen examples, and I see year after year exhausted entrepreneurs that have given too much attention to their development and not enough to their customer development. So think about your business model. You have to design your business model. It should be planned. It should be done from the start. You should have at least one idea of your business model. It will evolve, but you should have at least one idea of your business model. Use it as a communication tool. You know, it's often hard in a startup setting. You have to argue between developers, between the marketeers, between business people, raising money, and so on. It is a tool that can flatten many differences and can allow you to understand better the implication of everyone in the company. Very important, test your hypothesis, not to go into a crash, or go into a crash because it's a metaphorical crash and there's no people involved. So learn to fail fast. If the idea doesn't work, crash it and learn from it and pivot and start a new one. You know, well, and to test your hypothesis, get out of the building. It won't happen in front of the blackboard. You have to go and talk to the customer. That's the whole principle of customer development. Pivot if needed, and it's very often time needed. There was a study, you know, there are people studying that, and there's a study that shown that out of 1,000 companies, the most successful in the past few years had pivoted around two times, like 1.9 times or 2.1, I don't recall. They were more successful than the ones having pivoted zero time. That means the companies that had an initial plan and executed on their initial plan, no matter what. But there were some that did worse. It was the companies that pivoted four times. You know, one after a while, if you keep on pivoting, then you're becoming a turning dancer, and it doesn't serve your purpose. And only once you've found, you know, through pivoting, through testing, to designing your business model, getting out of the building, pivoting, only then execute. And then you can bring the people with the traditional way of thinking, the suits and the ties and everything. The execution, of course, is really key, but only once you've gone through the first stages. I think this maps pretty much to one of Ben's slides about in five or six stages, how much you should raise and so on. I would advise not to raise around 200. €1,000 unless you have done the steps before, found your business model and done your customer development right. And I think that this is really key if you want to avoid crashes and avoid tears and frozen and frustrated founders and so on. All right, that's it. Thank you. Oops. If you want to go deeper in this, this is something that we practice regularly at the MIC, at the old MIC, in the MIC in Mons, MIC in Brussels. We can do an intensive session on your project, on your entrepreneurial idea and design and develop your business model with you.